current state on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. It is Monday, the last day of the month, and everyone would prefer that one team or another from the state of Michigan be represented in the NCAA Final Four. Alas, it is not to be in 2014. But what's the old saying? One door closes and another opens, right? Tigers first pitch, 1:08 this afternoon. We'll talk about baseball since the basketball didn't work out. We want to congratulate the Spartans and the Wolverines on tremendous seasons, though. Later on this hour, we talk about an event coming up at the Wharton Center that shares stories of personal failures, the Failure Lab. And apparently this can have a catalytic effect on some number of people who hear, often well-known people, share stories of failure. It can have a reinforcing effect. Mark Hollis is one of the people sharing an account of failure, apparently as part of this thing coming up at the Wharton Center. We will talk with an organizer, amongst other things here, this hour on Current State. At the end of every calendar month, Current State hosts its regular reporter roundtable to review the biggest stories of that month. And joining us to look back at the drop out of a shoe-in, we'll call it, the unresolved gay marriage issue, the bumps facing road funding. It's Elaine Culhannock, Community Conversations Editor at the Lansing State Journal. Hi, Elaine.
Hi.
Kathy Gray covers the Capitol for the Detroit Free Press. Welcome back, Kathy.
Hi, Mark.
And covering this week for regular Tim Skubick, we're pleased to welcome back Mickey Hurton, Associate Publisher of the Lansing City Pulse.
Mark, happy to be here.
Mickey, great to have you. We've all had a few more days to get used to the idea of a new U.S. congressperson representing Michigan's 8th District, which includes Lansing and East Lansing, of course. After a weekend to let it sink in, what are your thoughts, Mickey?
Well, I mean, they seem to be scrambling on both sides, Democrats and Republicans. I think we'll get a little clarity by the end of the week. The Democrats were out polling this weekend. They did some automated polls. In fact, we got one at home. And I know some of the candidates will be polling themselves, but they've got to move very quickly. But you talk of Bonero, Byram, and Bishop are the ones that were cited in the polling by the Democratic Congressional Committee.
Okay. Easy enough to remember the last names. Kathy, any thoughts?
Well, Mike Rogers really put everybody in the lurch because he quit so abruptly. This was a real surprise. Mm-hmm. And the candidates only have until April 22nd to put together their team, to gather 1,000 signatures, and to decide whether they're going to run or not. So there are a lot of people scrambling out there who had no thought of doing that before, because if Rogers ran again, he would get reelected.
Virge Bonero denied on Friday that, he made it clear he feels he has an awful lot of work to do here in Lansing. Elaine, do you think he could change his mind about that?
Well, I would never say never, but I think that he was pretty sincere about it, and I think there's enough other Democrats out there throwing their hats in.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I know he's polling this week. He is commissioning. He's going to commission a poll.
He's commissioning his own poll?
Well, yep. And once everybody started reporting, oh, no, I'm intending to stay in Lansing, all of a sudden everybody's getting emails saying, hey, no, wait, there's still a possibility that I could run. Who knows what he's going to do?
Any other names outside the three B's arise to the
sure.
top for you?
There's a lot. Barb Byram, I think, is one of the leading Democrats. Mike Bishop is one of the leading Republicans. However, I got several emails over the weekend saying he's not conservative enough.
Bishop?
Yeah. So I think that you're going to see someone further right from Bishop, who's going to try to make an attempt. You got Senator Joe Hune, who's thinking about it seriously.
Solanuzis
is also thinking about it, but his name recognition isn't quite as good as some of the others. So,
Mickey, you would suggest that Mike Bishop is sufficiently conservative to run in the 8th district?
Well, I guess it depends how you look at the district. I know that when the local polls look at this race, they think Livingston County is where it's won or lost. Like with Bonero, can he position himself in Livingston County to pick up enough votes? I mean, they see the Dems certainly see Ingham County as safe. and it extends over as far as parts of Oakland.
Well,
right?
And Oakland is the largest population center of it, but it's the northern tier of Oakland County into Rochester, and that's pretty Republican territory. There aren't any Democratic elected officials really in that general area, so you're not going to see it. You're probably not going to see a Democratic candidate from Oakland County in the race.
Bill Ballinger was here on Friday of Inside Michigan Politics. He emphasized the 8th is not as red as an awful lot of people seem to think.
Yeah, I think I was seeing what it's only about considered 2 points to the red.
53-54%.
Okay, he said 54, if
and,
I'm not mistaken.
You've got Lansing, so which is highly Democratic. So if you've got a big Democratic turnout, which is questionable in a in an off presidential election year, so it's that's a little bit sketchy. I'm not sure if a Dem can do it, but.
One of the things they're trying to avoid, too, the reason the Democrats are out polling now is they'd love to avoid a primary fight in this.
Yeah.
Because that'll be just, first, it'll be the usual primary bloodbath. And secondly, it'll cost a lot of money. They could spend $500,000 easily on a primary bid. So what they would like to do is, I think, sort of find the candidate, find the one they think has the best opportunity to challenge, and then save their money for what will no doubt be a well-funded Republican bid for this seat.
In the end, how excited should Democrats be about this opportunity?
Well, it doesn't come along very often. So, yeah, they should be excited. For somebody like Barb Byram, she doesn't have to quit her job to run for this seat, so it's a kind of a free shot for her.
I guess what crosses my mind is that given that it does favor the Republicans, the district favors the Republicans just slightly, could you argue that the Democrats... the Democratic candidate has to be viewed fairly favorably by swing voters.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can't forget the woman vote either. And
good point.
And so if you've got Byram in there, she's got all sorts of you know, not only is she a woman, but she was involved in the whole mess last year when the female speakers were gaveled down.
Right. So nobody's announced yet. How much longer do we have to wait?
By the end of the week.
Absolutely.
You'll start
end of the week.
Well, they have no time. I mean, you've got
the 22nd is the registration deadline.
But even getting your signatures, I mean, it sounds simple to say, "Oh, go get 1,000 signatures," but the, you know, the petitioning process has to be very specific and absolute, and, you know, I mean, it's just a lot to organize.
Well, just go ask Thad McCotter how easy it is to get signatures.
Yeah,
so.
Real signatures or
real signatures.
Real signatures. That's the ones you're talking about.
I think the one thing I think about Bernero is he does have statewide recognition. I mean, if there's anyone, I mean, he did run for governor and got a lot of votes against an unbelievably well-funded Snyder campaign. So he has it, his statewide reputation, that could be work for him or against him, but he's also on television a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, so he is, if there's anyone who's a standard bearer, it could be him, but, you know, again, it cuts both ways.
Let's move to the various developments this month relating to gay marriage here in Michigan. There were several. First and foremost, of course, Judge Friedman's ruling a week ago Friday that the state's same-sex marriage ban is unconstitutional. Last week, a few days after about 300 marriages that took place, including quite a few in Mason at the Ingham County Courthouse, Governor Snyder had this to say.
But because of the stay, that the operation of law is such that we won't recognize the benefits of that marriage until there's a removal of the stay or there's an upholding of the judge's opinion by the Court of Appeals or a higher court.
More recently, of course, on Friday, the U.S. Department of Justice announced it would recognize the marriages as legal. That would make the couples eligible for federal benefits. What does all of this legal limbo add up to?
Well, it leaves those 300 couples in limbo for the indefinite future, and probably until next summer, because the Supreme Court is probably going to be the one that's going to end up deciding this issue. And they'll take it perhaps one of the cases. There's about 9 of them out there that they could choose from to decide whether these bans are unconstitutional or not. They won't make a decision probably until next summer. So the couples are, as far as the state is concerned, are up in the air until then.
Just an appalling decision by Snyder. I mean, what he's done is he's created an entirely new class of citizens in this state. You could be single, You could be married with full benefits, or you could be married without benefits. What kind of decision is that? I mean, he's clearly tried to split the baby, play both sides against the middle, and it's just, it's a failure of leadership, in my view.
Well, it's the kind of social issue that the governor would appear to have little, if any, use for.
Well, too bad.
Correct.
He's governor. You know, he makes the case that I'm focused on the economy. I've got to focus on jobs. Uh-huh. Well, you know, sometimes you have to juggle things. You know, you're out there as a chief executive of the state. Other issues come up. I mean, you can't be that single-minded when there are other issues that the people expect leadership on. And I think his inability to juggle is a surprising detriment to our local governments.
It raises the question of whether or not this is another issue that could further divide the GOP in an election year. Your thoughts?
Well, I guess it is. I mean, when you talk about if you want to focus on jobs, there are a lot of companies that think acceptance of diversity is an important value in the employees they want. And there are a lot of companies that offer same-sex benefits for people, and they have to do that to get top talent. So if you're going to have a state that's going to refuse to acknowledge that, I think there would be some businesses that would come out and say, this is not such a business-friendly policy.
Well, we've heard of gay couples leaving the state so they can start families.
You know, so that's, I think that's a factor that that really ought to be considered. I can't, you know, and when this first started, I thought people were trying to say Snyder wasn't going to have a position, and then they dug out, of course, his material from the last election where he had that one or two lines in a debate, and then he gave a quote
to the Associated Press.
It's very fuzzy.
Comments from maybe 2011, maybe 10.
Yeah.
I can't remember the year.
When
marriage is between a man and a woman.
But everyone has the right to partake in contracts.
Okay.
But this is the same, isn't it? It's not on his agenda till it's on his agenda.
Well, the thing is he didn't make anybody happy with this thing. He, the same-sex couples are happy that their marriage is legal, but they're very unhappy that they're not recognized. The Republicans who don't agree with him aren't happy that he said that the marriages are legal. They don't view the marriages as legal because right now the state's constitution says that they're not. So he didn't make anybody happy with this thing.
And isn't it amazing that he didn't have an answer immediately? I mean, it's not like you saw this case. It was going to go one of two ways.
Months out.
Yeah. You know, judge was going to, you know, throw out the state law, or he wasn't. And then they seemed caught by surprise by this. And it just seems you would have known. I mean,
in an election year, what does this add up to for the governor?
Well, I mean, I think it's something that he's going
to
get asked about a lot between now and November. And every time you dance around it, you know, and plus he, in a certain way, with a certain segment of voters, he opens himself up to the whole dancing around right to work until he didn't. You know, I mean, how many things cannot be on your agenda until they are?
It's a pretty nice gift for Mark Schauer, the Democratic candidate, I think, because it offers him a position on an issue that generally is popular with people more for it than against it. And also
59%, I read last
week. And it also deals with Snyder as a leader. And I think leadership, you know, it's a hoary cliche until you look for it and then you want it. So I think he's a pretty happy guy.
Well, this is
today.
Where political leadership can be different from business leadership. I mean, the fact of the matter is, and you're a political leader, you have to get into policies that are social policies, not just economic policies.
Right. Good
and
point.
There's no way around that.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to navigate those shoals, and he doesn't want to.
Attorney General Bill Schuette figures heavily in the gay marriage debate, and he launched his campaign for another term last week. How newsworthy a development was the launch, and what kind of commentary did it generate?
Well, the interesting thing was that this Judge Friedman just eviscerated Schuette's case.
Yes,
called his witnesses totally unbelievable, and this comes out almost the same day that he is launching his campaign. The launch of his campaign was lost. Nobody was talking about that. Everybody was talking about the decision. So, I mean, everybody knows he's running for re-election. But I think that this one hurts him because the case that the state presented was not great.
And I think, didn't he also say when he, in his campaign, as he's defending his decision to appeal this, he's now basing it on the state's constitution rather than this very specious argument that somehow children are hurt. He seems to have eliminated that argument.
It's the 2004 vote.
You know, it's a real tightrope that these guys are walking because all of a sudden they're softening their tone. Schuette really started to soften his tone last week, saying, you know, all kids need are loving parents, whether they're gay, whether they're straight, whatever. And so all of a sudden he's having to walk this tightrope too, because there are people out there who are raising children and you don't want to totally slam them. And I think Snyder is doing the same thing. He's walking that tightrope, and I think that's a really difficult balance.
How much of a contest? What does that say about the contest for Attorney General here in Michigan against Democrat Mark Totten?
Well,
how much does that benefit?
I mean, the Democrat. The Attorney General job is just the softest political spot you can have. I mean, you come up with policies, you come up with task forces. I mean, it's tailor-made for re-election. So I can't see a serious challenge myself on that, because you play, you're able to just try to please everybody with policies and law proposals, but you don't really have to deliver on them.
It would seem this would add up to a greater advantage here, though.
People don't know Mark Totten. Nobody knows who he is. He's very capable. He's done a lot of different things, but there's just absolutely no name recognition. And keep in mind, he may not be the candidate. He still has to go through the nominating process.
No chance of an anybody but Schuette movement developing here.
It's always a possibility, but you've got to get somebody who has got a little bit more juice.
Not much of a bench on the Dems on that side anyway.
It's been six decades, I read, since an incumbent attorney general lost an election here in Michigan. 1954 was the last time that happened. It is the season to bellyache about the roads with growing justification. The photo of the man-eater in front of the Kellogg Center here in East Lansing made NPR, for crying out loud. A truck out repairing a pothole creates an even bigger crater in the process of repairing one. And it seems that the season did trigger some discussion here this month. Did a road funding discussion just continue this month, Kathy, or could you argue that it moved forward?
Oh, it absolutely moved forward. You know, Snyder has been calling for increased investment for a couple of years now in the roads, $1.2 billion a year that he thinks that it's needed. And the legislature just has not been willing to do that because you've got to raise a lot of taxes and fees and things like that in order to do that. It's hard to do in an election year. But all of a sudden, you've got this horrendous winter that we've had, and you're starting to see rebar in the road, mm-hmm. as the potholes go that deep, so
that may be better. You know, at least there's something there.
Yeah. So, you know, all these lawmakers are hearing from their constituents saying, "Oh my gosh, fix the roads! I've got a $900 repair bill."
And they're back in their districts now. Too,
absolutely,
right?
Yeah. for three weeks. So you're going to see some movement on this. You're not going to see $1.2 billion figure out how to do that, but you're going to see some movement.
Could the road debate and demands for action kill the proposal for an income tax rollback?
Absolutely.
You're nodding yes.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I think everybody has pretty much agreed with that.
Is it becoming an election issue? Could it become an election issue for any number of legislators?
Sure. From the governor on down, because they have not been able to come up with a solution. And people want their roads fixed. People don't want their fillings coming out as they're driving down Michigan roads.
And, you know, I had a relative who spent some time in southeast Michigan, not this past weekend, but the weekend before, and he maintains, as bad as they may seem here in mid-Michigan, they are arguably really a lot worse in southeast Michigan.
Where there's more traffic,
Oakland County.
Worse.
I mean, it's a regressive tax when you think about it. I mean, it just, you're going to pay. I mean, people with old cars will break down more, you know, more likely to break down in potholes. They will pay the cost. We all pay it one way or another.
And these are not inexpensive repairs. I mean, when you talk $950, I was at the, I got an oil change a couple weeks ago, and one of the fellows waiting for his car had just hit. He's calling home to say, well, I'm at the dealership because I hit a pothole on MLK and took out, you know, two rims. It's $1,500.
Yeah.
It's not a small amount of money for folks.
A couple of these stories that we've been talking about have had a tendency, especially in the last couple of weeks, I think, to really distract people from other things that are going on. Do any of you have an overlooked or underreported story from March?
Well, one that I haven't done much with is, and there hasn't been a whole lot done, is all these human trafficking bills that are making their way through the legislature. This is a big issue that Schuette and a number of Republican and Democratic lawmakers started talking about last year, cracking down on human trafficking of young people. And the problem is that they just haven't been able to really come up with some solid numbers as to how big of a problem it really is, if it is a big problem. So that's mine.
The unwillingness, it seems, of the federal government to build the plaza for the bridge, the proposed bridge to Canada, is sort of disappointing.
What's going on there?
Well, apparently there's money to build the bridge, but there's no money to build the toll plaza. And it's about, I guess, $100 million.
It was left out of Obama's budget.
It's a lot.
Well, and it's far down on the list of infrastructure projects, those types of infrastructure border projects that the federal government is looking at. The Blue Water Bridge is higher on the list than the Windsor Crossing. So
there were also, this pops into my head, there were also accusations recently that the Snyder administration did a favor for a cousin of the governor, George Snyder, who's in the furniture business and allegedly stood to lose state business under a bill a few years ago. The accusation is that Budget Director John Nixon got involved. Rich Baird, former chief of the now defunct Nerd Fund, got involved. Where is this? Does this story have traction?
It's certainly going to become an election issue, because it is Snyder's cousin, George Snyder, who was emailing back and forth with Rich Baird, you know, worrying about this budget and we'll take care of it. But he also, the cousin also has had contracts with the state for a long time prior to Snyder becoming governor. So that's how it might shake out.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, Snyder's already said that it's nothing but a political distraction by the Democrats, but you're right. I mean, all these little things begin to stick, and it's not one, but it's, you know, it's gay marriage, and it's this, and it's, you know, it's many, and that's, you know, elections are framed on that sometimes.
Mickey and Elaine, you in particular, we'll all be looking at the BWL report, well, the Community Review Team report coming up in the coming days. What do you anticipate?
I think it's going to be very thorough, and I think it's probably going to have some difficult recommendations. I suspect that they may very well go into governance. I don't know that. I've not talked to General McDaniel, but I think that may be part of it, and I think there'll be some unhappiness on the BW, you know, with some of the BWL board members when they see how thorough it is. Mm-hmm. And
Mickey, what are you going to be looking at first and foremost when you get your hands on this?
Well, I mean, I think we know an awful lot of what happened. I mean, it's come out at the hearings. We know that the communication plan was a mess, that they weren't prepared, their computer systems were inadequate, that they didn't have sufficient numbers of crews. I think the report, as Elaine says, will be really thorough. I'm not sure what it will all mean when it gets done. I don't see them calling for Lark's head. I think they may look for some restructuring and new policies and procedures. But at the end, I mean, I think it'll tell us much of what we know. We will find out they were just unprepared culturally and, you know, and physically for this kind of a storm. And they'll learn from this, but I think in a year we'll just go, yeah, whatever. It's all been, you know, it's over. And it sort of is over. I mean, people who are really annoyed are less annoyed now because they're out in the yard.
I'm going to disagree with you. I think that governance issue is not going to go away. Well, I think the folks in East Lansing, those are highly educated people, and they're motivated at the moment. And the Delta Township folks are also angry, and I don't think they're going to go away.
Well, what are they going to do? They can't do anything. They're going to, you know, join a new utility?
Well,
they have no cloud at all.
I think they're going to keep I think that issue is not going to go away.
But they have no.
I disagree with you.
They have no standing. They can either get their power from consumers or BWL,
but they can't.
And they can't.
You can't just up and go get your power somewhere else.
So
Verge
gives
them. Where you're wired
in. So the city gives them some ex officio status.
Seats on the board.
Yeah, and they can become an observers and they can watch, but there's nothing that forces the city to do that other than goodwill.
We will have you two back after we get the report in our hands. I think we've got a segment all set to go.
We'll
want to
see.
Thank
blame you.
Yeah.
Mickey Hurt.
Like, I haven't heard that line in a minute.
Hey, Mark, happy birthday, buddy.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, thank you. Appreciate it. Mickey Hurton, thanks very much. Associate publisher of the Lansing City Pulse. Kathy Gray covers the Capitol for the Detroit Free Press. Elaine Culhannock of the Lansing State Journal. Many thanks.
Thanks, Mark.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. While for some media outlets, photography is taking a back seat, at National Geographic, it continues to be a central part of the brand. The photos featured in the magazine not only take readers around the world, but they also help tell the story of our changing environment. Dennis Dimmick is the executive environment editor at National Geographic. He'll be speaking at MSU's Fate of the Earth inaugural symposium on April 3rd. Current State's Emmanuel Berry spoke with Dimmick about covering climate change and his love of photography.
How were you introduced to photography? Was it part of your early childhood or something you discovered later in life?
I was introduced to photography actually when I was very small. My grandfather, my mother's father, was a physician and had cameras and was always photographing us and then showing us the pictures that he made in his dark room. And I never really fully pursued it until I was in college. I did a few things when I was in grade school and high school. For example, I had a 4-H potato project where I actually did panoramic pictures of the field, and I would take black and white pictures and go to the drugstore with a roll of film, bring the prints back, and then tape them together and create panoramic multi-image pictures. But it was actually in college when I first got serious about it. I wanted to do it, had never explored it, and it was about the time that Time Life came out with a beautiful library of books on photography, the Time Life Library of Photography. And about that time, I went, oh, well, I can read these books and learn how to do it. And so I bought a used camera, and then I had a college roommate who saw that I was interested in it, and he introduced me to the news editor at the student newspaper at Oregon State. And by the time I was actually a sophomore, I had been doing it for less than a year. I was taking pictures for the student newspaper.
Photography is so central to National Geographic, and including in this coverage of climate change that you guys do. What do photos share, or what are photos able to tell people that words alone cannot about climate change?
Well, photography can bear witness, and photography can actually show change, and you can take a picture from one time period and pair it with another picture from a later time period, and you can say, see, the world is changing. We did this in 2007. I began working with Jim Balog, the photographer who has since gone on to create Extreme Ice Survey. He was featured in a film last year called Chasing Ice, and it's this whole story of documenting global change through the changing glaciers of the planet. And it's all about being able to show change. It's about being able to show how people are being affected. Photography communicates in a different way than words do, in the sense that words can cumulatively paint a picture of a scene in the mind of a reader, and a photograph actually can do that instantaneously. And then it's more than just one picture, but it's like what we try to do is imagine that what we're doing really is producing a documentary film in still images. And so it is a way for us to, we use the moment of in a photograph to cause people to stop and contemplate, but then we're also using a series of photographs to help create a sense of witness, to help people have a sense of actually having been there with the photographer who's bearing witness for them. Of course, words can do that same kind of thing, but it's more of an accumulative kind of impact. And great writing, some of the best writing that we have is the kind that paints pictures in people's minds, creates scenes, transports readers to the place with them. But our best photography can also do that instantaneously.
For many people, National Geographic is a standard. Everyone has those yellow bindings, stacks of them,
sure,
on shelves. And it, when you flip through it, just kind of seems like the ideal or the dream job. Has it been a dream job for you? Is it a dream job?
For me, it's been a fascinating experience because I've been able to essentially create my own existence. The work that I do is really not something that somebody told me I was supposed to do. It was work that I wanted to do and wanted to, I mean, it's basically like somebody who keeps coming up with their own projects for 20 years to get to convince people here that we need to do a story on soil conservation or to do a series of stories on climate change or to a series on global food security that runs for 8 months. That's kind of what I've been trying to do, and it's fabulous to be able to come up with ideas and create constituencies and enthusiasm for projects and then see them come to fruition. So it's really, I mean, it's all about being a change agent.
What are your thoughts on the coverage of climate change? Is media doing enough to talk about these concerns and potential issues in the future?
The coverage of climate change is a very difficult topic for news media because it's not just climate that you have to address. You actually have to make sense of it. You have to take a step back and speak to why is the climate shifting? Why are we seeing changes in the behavior of the climate system? And it all comes down to what choices society makes as far as energy. Of course, there's impact from land transformation, carbon dioxide and methane emissions from disrupting landscapes, deforestation, and that. But the prime drivers, I mean, if people are willing to accept the role of science in society, scientists say carbon emissions from the fuels that we are burning are the dominant driver of the changes that we're seeing in the behavior of the climate system. So if that's the case, it's really not just a story about covering the changes in the climate. You have to draw the circle of consideration big enough to speak to the causation behind the changes. And that lands squarely at the choices that we're making in terms of energy that we make. It's difficult because it's one thing to say, oh, well, things are warming up, we're seeing more extreme weather, ice is melting, seas are rising, it's another thing completely to say, well, and what are we going to do about it? We're going to actually change the whole world energy system. So it's not just a story about covering climate change. It's like energy and climate are two halves of the whole. And when you start talking about how you're going to go about changing the way we use energy, that's a different question than identifying what the problem is. Then it becomes an economics question, it becomes a policy question, it becomes a money question, it becomes a vested interest question, it becomes a question about, well, it took us a very long time to build the infrastructure that we currently have to power the world, whether it's digging up coal and burning it to generate electricity or to pump oil out of the ground. It turns wheels, and it's a great fuel for turning wheels. But then the question is, how can you create alternate systems that are also going to be, over time, cost-effective and scalable to replace the existing systems? And it took us decades and centuries to get where we are. If people think we're just going to, like, all change our light bulbs and drive hybrids, that's not going to do it. It's a huge-scale problem, and it's going to take a long time.
You'll be at Michigan State University on campus on Thursday as part of the Fate of the Earth inaugural symposium. And actually, one of your first environmental talks, as you were saying, was given at MSU 10 years ago. Right. What are some of the issues you plan to cover in your discussion this time around?
This time, what I'm going to try to do is lay out an emergent idea called the Anthropocene Epoch, which is It is by no means a formal thing, but it's an interesting way to think about the relationship of the human condition to the planet that supports us. Some scientists, geologists, have proposed that there be a new kind of geologic era, epoch, here at the end of the Holocene, meaning that it's this era of man, the one where we as a species are actually so significant in our presence and impact on the planet that we are, that this really, it's our planet to manage now. And what happens to our future is also going to be determined by choices that we make now. And largely this talk will be, it's a provocation. I'm trying to basically lay out the best of our knowledge as to what we're doing, but I'm also going to talk about what are some of the, you know, the choices and the opportunities.
Well, Dennis, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Great. Thank you so much, and I look forward to seeing all of you.
Dennis Dimmick is the executive environment editor at National Geographic Magazine. He'll be speaking at the Fate of the Earth inaugural symposium on Thursday. The event is open to the public and is being held at the Kellogg Center. For Current State, I'm Emmanuel Berry.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR reaches via email at currentstate@wkar.org. One of the issues being considered at the state capitol in recent weeks is the regulation of e-cigarettes. E-cigarettes are electronic devices that heat up a liquefied nicotine solution that produces a vapor rather than the smoke from tobacco cigarettes. Users of e-cigarettes say they've quit smoking tobacco or now take in less nicotine. Health officials counter that we don't know enough about the effects of e-cigarettes and that they need more regulation, especially their availability to minors. Current State's Scott Pohl has more on e-cigarettes in Michigan.
Perhaps you've seen the TV ads like these for the market-leading blue e-cigarettes with actors Stephen Dorff and Jenny McCarthy.
I've been a smoker for 20 years. And I just found the smarter alternative, blue e-cigs. Blue lets me enjoy smoking without it affecting the people around me, because it's vapor, not tobacco smoke.
Now that I've switched to blue, I feel better about myself. and I feel free to have one almost anywhere. When I'm driving, at home, watching TV. Finally with Blue, I took back my freedom.
According to Consumer Reports magazine, sales of e-cigarettes grew from $500 million in 2012 to $1.5 billion last year. Dr. Matt Davis is the chief medical executive of the Michigan Department of Community Health, which wants e-cigarettes to be treated as a tobacco product, taxed like tobacco, and subject to clean indoor air laws. He's monitoring the research being done on e-cigarettes. Dr. Davis wants to know more about what's in an e-cigarette besides nicotine. Users aren't getting the tars found in cigarettes, but it's possible that they're inhaling other substances, some of which also come from tobacco leaves.
One of the greatest concerns I have as a public health official in Michigan is that one or more of those substances may be cancer-causing. Researchers have shown that e-cigarette liquid, or the vape liquid, includes something called nitrosamine, which is known to cause cancer. The proponents of e-cigarettes often say that, well, these are quite different than tobacco cigarettes. That may be true, but it only takes one cancer-causing substance to cause cancer.
In Lansing, state lawmakers from both sides of the aisle have started to take notice. Currently, e-cigarettes can be sold to anyone in Michigan, regardless of their age. Senate Democrat Glenn Anderson says it isn't clear to him if e-cigarettes are a tobacco product.
That's the issue of whether we get something through to get them out of the hands of minors or whether we go through this protracted battle and waiting for the feds and waiting for a decision as to whether or not it's the same as a tobacco product. And we chose not to fight that battle now, but do the right thing and get them out of the hands of minors.
Some of those young users might be drawn in by vaping flavors like cherry and vanilla. That sort of access prompted the Senate to approve legislation banning the sale of e-cigarettes to minors. It was introduced by Senator Anderson and Republican Rick Jones. It carries a $50 fine for both the seller and underage buyers. Jones says he doesn't object to adults having access to e-cigarettes, but they should be kept away from kids.
I've heard of children, you know, easily 10 years old getting this product. In fact, Friday, I was reading to a fourth grade, and one of the children mentioned to me that his friend bought one and they played with it.
Governor Rick Snyder has weighed in. He thinks e-cigarettes should be treated as a tobacco product rather than being regulated separately.
It's a real issue about the substance itself. Is it really a tobacco product or not? And if it is a tobacco product and it's largely liquid nicotine, shouldn't it be treated that way?
So far, the governor hasn't said if he would veto legislation that doesn't treat e-cigarettes the same as tobacco products. Hal Prentice is a name longtime WKAR listeners will remember. Until his retirement a few years ago, he was WKAR's radio station manager and classical music host. A smoker of up to two packs a day for decades, Prentice had tried many times unsuccessfully to quit. About a year ago, he was visiting his sisters in Arizona. Both were former smokers, but they had switched to e-cigarettes.
They said, "You really have to try this." And I was reticent, but I went along with it. And they took me to the local shop in Tucson. And I bought the device. And within 2 days, I had stopped smoking tobacco.
E-cigarettes come in several nicotine levels. And Prentice says he has stepped down his intake, though at this point he can't say if he'll ever go to a zero-level e-cigarette or quit using the device altogether. Prentice thought he never would fully break away from cigarettes.
All of a sudden, you know, I had this device and I wasn't suffering physiologically, you know, from withdrawals or anything like that. It was very comfortable. It has just really changed my life to a certain degree. I never thought I could beat it. And I tried so hard so many different times, and this did it in 2 days.
Prentice says a nasty smoker's cough has almost disappeared. He also thinks he's saving money now, spending perhaps 75% less than what he used to spend on tobacco cigarettes. Dr. Matt Davis of the State Department of Community Health has heard similar stories from his patients, but he has reservations about promoting e-cigarettes as a quit-smoking tool.
In head-to-head trials of e-cigarettes versus something like a nicotine patch, e-cigarettes were equal to the nicotine patch in terms of helping people quit. Not better, but not worse. So as a public health official and as a primary care doctor, I have to ask myself, well, does that mean we should use e-cigarettes as a way for people to quit smoking? That's certainly how people are talking about them today. The problem is that I know a lot more about a nicotine patch than I do about an e-cigarette. And in my mind, the safety and the effectiveness of nicotine patches is a better bet than an e-cigarette today.
One last concern about e-cigarettes has come to light. The New York Times recently reported on the risks associated with the e-liquids that can be purchased as e-cigarette refills. Exposure to small amounts of liquefied nicotine, either ingested or absorbed through the skin, can cause vomiting and seizures. Reports of accidental poisonings are skyrocketing. One death, a suicide by an adult who injected a nicotine solution, has been reported, and a 2-year-old Oklahoma City girl needed emergency room treatment after drinking a small bottle of liquid nicotine. And liquid nicotine is available online, not just in tiny amounts. It can be purchased by the liter, by the gallon, even by the barrel, and in varying potencies. Lee Cantrell, a professor of pharmacy at the University of California, San Francisco, tells The Times that a teaspoonful of a 10% solution could kill an adult. The State House has yet to take up the e-cigarette regulation approved by the Senate. Stories of accidental poisonings could help those who would keep e-cigarettes out of the hands of minors get the legislation through the House after their next break and earn the governor's signature. For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Earlier this year, Current State's Emmanuel Berry introduced listeners to Failure Lab. The event asks presenters to share a story of failure with the world. Tomorrow, Tales of Defeat will be showcased at the Wharton Center as part of a joint effort between Michigan State University and Failure Lab. This event marks the first time Failure Lab has partnered with a university. Jonathan Williams is one of the creators of Failure Lab. John, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You spoke with Current State's Emmanuel Berry about this earlier this year, but remind our listeners about how Failure Lab got started.
Yeah, it started in Detroit, actually, from a TED Talk by Randall Charlton. And at that time, he was the CEO of TechTown, and he just gave a really powerful, strong story about huge personal and professional failures. And at the end, he kind of talked about regaining his confidence. And our founder, Jordan O'Neill, drove back to Grand Rapids, and he couldn't stop thinking about what if he had just ended it at the end of the failure and walked off stage. What would that feel like? What would a room feel like if you did that? And we experimented with it in Grand Rapids at the Wealthy Theater and sold the first show out. And we did another one 6 months later in Detroit. And now we're coming to Michigan State.
And how does a Failure Lab event work exactly?
Yeah, it's an intimate evening showcasing real failures from six successful people. So the format blends music with impactful stories. So you'll start with an entertainer. And what that really acts is kind of clearing the room, recharging the air, and then you hear a 9-minute, very personal story of failure from a successful individual. And then kind of our special ingredient is after each story, we invite the audience to enter the story by giving their lessons and their feedback. Our speakers aren't sharing lessons. They're really more just confessing a struggle. And so we take the audience lessons from Twitter or in the bulletin and we publish them online. And what you get is just hundreds of beautiful thoughts from people who are internalizing their own struggles. And when you don't tell people what to think, you get to hear what they think. And that's really kind of the magic sauce of Failure Lab.
And hearing these accounts from people that are largely successful now just enhances the impact, I take it.
Absolutely. And so often we don't get to hear these types of stories. And often your perception of success doesn't kind of carry with it what the actual path to get there. So it's really helpful to understand that you're not alone, that successful people make a lot of mistakes. And our ultimate goal is to encourage people to keep trying new things, to keep taking intelligent risks. And we believe by owning this and sharing this, it crushes the stigma and the isolation around failure.
Who will be sharing their stories of failure at this Wharton event?
Yeah, so we have Mark Hollis, who we consider one of the most progressive athletic directors in the country, so he's going to have a great story. We're flying in Mike Sager from San Diego, and he's a national best-selling author. Some of his stories inspired the movie Boogie Nights, so he wrote for Rolling Stone and Esquire and Playboy, and you can guarantee he's going to have a spicy story. We have a CEO, Jeff Barrett, who's responsible for huge viral videos. We have a Detroit MC and rapper, Ms. Corona. We have an attorney and a business owner, Jaquise Jurfoy. And we have also MSU's own dean of the College of Human Medicine, Marsha Rapley. Hmm. So we really cover a very diverse group of people and stories, and I think it's going to be both professional and personal and really going to have some impactful narrative.
And you and as we mentioned, you also feature artists in between the stories who will be performing.
Yeah, so we're really excited. This is the first time it's going to be an all-student cast of performers. So we have Joe Hertler, who's going to play. We have the Spartan Discords. We have some percussion. We have some singers. There's going to be a slam poet. And one of the speakers, Ms. Corona, will also rap in between as well. So it's going to be, the entertainment is all across the board as well. So there's really something for anyone at Failure Lab.
This is the first time you've held a Failure Lab in coordination with a university. What's the experience been like for you so far?
It has been awesome. We couldn't have found a better partner in ASMSU and Michigan State, and it's going to be at the Wharton Center's Cobb Hall, which is a beautiful venue. And it's just a really special time in someone's life before you're entering the workforce to hear from people who are already out there going through it. And Michigan State has been great. Mark Hollis has been a huge fan, and the Associated Press just picked up the talk or the event this morning. And so we're really excited to be in East Lansing and be involved in a really fun event there.
Really interesting stuff. Failure Lab, set for tomorrow night at Wharton Center. It includes Athletic Director Mark Hollis of Michigan State University. We've been talking with Jonathan Williams, one of the creators of Failure Lab. Jonathan, thanks. Good luck.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, we'll give you an update on the BP oil spill in Lake Michigan. Also, we discuss the Michigan Social Entrepreneurship Challenge. And MSU's Abrams Planetarium is celebrating 50 years. Learn more about how they'll mark the milestone tomorrow here on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our show's producer. Thanks to Emmanuel Berry, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery. Also to Aaron Young for engineering and Hannah Michael John for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us on Current State on WKAR.